Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, come back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Solomon Jagwe. Welcome.
Thank you.
I also want to say Jabelako Sebo.
Awesome. So Jabelako Sebo.
Jabelako Sebo.
Yeah, like it's almost like you're telling someone, it's almost like a casual greeting, mm-hmm. but you're telling them, you know, well done on the work that you're doing, kind of thing. Yeah.
So,
but if you're saying hello, you can say Sibio Cheno Sebo or Ogambachi, which is like a casual
Sibio Cheno Sibio Cheno Sebo.
Yeah, and then I would reply Sibio Burundi Nyabo. So you are Nyabo, I am Sebo.
Yes. So can you introduce yourself?
Yes. Guys, my name is Solomon Jagwe. I am an artist based here in the United States, but I'm originally born in Uganda and on the outskirts of the capital city, Kampala. I grew up on a hill to get a degree, just a degree in fine art. I currently run Soul Studios as a co-founder together with my wife. And I am the creator and director of The Adventures of Nkosa and Nanja. I think that's what most people know me by. Yes.
So for me, it kind of cut out when you say you grew up in a hill. You grew up in a hill named what?
Yeah. So the hill is called Mutundwe. It's on the outskirts of the capital city of Uganda. Yes.
So tell us a little bit about how it was growing up in Uganda.
Man. So especially in this, if we're talking about animation, yeah. So my art journey started way, way, way deep in the village. I was walking barefoot at some point in my life and just thinking about, you know, just life as a whole. As a kid, you're really not worried so much about a job or anything like that. But one thing that really fascinated me is that when I would look up in the sky, every now and then I would see these shiny little things flying in the sky, far off in the sky. And I wondered what that was. Of course, those were aeroplanes. I didn't know that I was an aeroplane at that time. But so I've always thinking about how whenever I write a story, I'm always taken back to that village moment when I was like, I wish I could get where those planes are. And I eventually got an opportunity to come here to the US to pursue a degree in fine art. But I've always been an artist, drawing anything that I came across. My brother and I, my brother Roland, who's right now in Arizona, we used to go up to that hill, Mutundwe Hill, and find any kind of creature we could find. And that's how I got into drawing.
So what about more like, you know, what did you do when you were a child? Not necessarily related to animation, but just like how was your childhood, siblings, all that type of stuff?
So I come from a huge family. So if I even try to count them, on my dad's side, we are like 8 sisters and 4 boys. So that mm-hmm. was a household of 12 kids. You can imagine mm-hmm. that. And mm-hmm. so there was a lot of you know, joy in the household. And I'm a middle child, so I'm number 7. I'm in those 12, and my three brothers love art as well. So we grew up reading Asterix and Obelix, you know, Tintin. That's what got me into loving comic books. We love reading those books. And being a middle child, you know, you tend to kind of be forgotten a lot. So you try to find your way. And so I would find myself in the back shade, you know, just drawing things, creating, you know, transmitters, creating my own radio and things like that. And most of my life in school was in boarding school. Mm-hmm. So most of us, kids around my age, used to go to missionary schools, you know, and so they would send you off for like 3 months. And then you come home for maybe 3 weeks, you know, in the between the semesters. And so when you're in that school system, you learn to make friends. You know, you are forced to learn how to make friends, because if you don't see your parents for 3 months, there will be some times when they'll allow parents to come on like visiting Sundays. And then they bring you some grub, you know, but for the most part of it, you're trying to survive as much as possible. Yeah.
So, I know there's like similarities between, you know, what Black Americans went through and like colonization on the continent, but like, what effect did the missionary schools have on like your learning your culture?
It had a major impact, especially on my art journey as well. Because I remember when I was in a boarding school, I went to a school called Budo Junior School. And in that school, we were not allowed to speak our native languages, right? And so they would actually give you a sackcloth with so many holes in it, dirty looking sackcloth. And you have to wear, if you mention even one word or phrase in our language, like Luganda or any other, they call it vernacular. And so they put that sackcloth on you and you stand in a place somewhere in the quadrangle. And it was like seriously shaming you for speaking your own language. And that kind of drove me to find a way, like, how do I help revitalize this love for our culture, as much as possible? So I wanted to use my art and using animation as a medium to be able to create stories that will bring back to life those stories. Because I grew up with my grandmother, spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and in the evenings we didn't really have TV at the time, so it was really entertainment. The entertainment that we had was my grandmother sitting me down in the evenings and telling me stories, folk tales in Uganda, and that's how I developed the love for storytelling.
Nice. Yeah, and you mentioning you're a big family, like my mom is like one of 14, and she calls herself Henry the Eighth. There's a song associated that she will willingly sing. But and then my dad is like one of 11 plus, and so I don't want to count my cousins either.
Yeah, because I'm like, seriously, if I, because I, my dad, I, on my mom's side, we have another, I have like seven si siblings on that side. And then by this time, if I said my sisters, most of them have cute children. So I have nieces and nephews that are so many.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge family.
It's too many to keep track of. So what would you say are your best childhood memories?
Oh man, I think chasing after like grasshoppers, and we call them white ants, and fruits, just going and climbing mango trees wherever you could. Things just seem to grow in Uganda. You eat a mango, drop it in a place somewhere, come back like 2 weeks later, something has grown in that place. It was incredible. Like in Uganda, it's so beautiful in terms of the way the nature just grows, right? So I think those are the most beautiful things about my childhood. And also, one memory that sticks out is how I came to actually learn how to draw a horse. Right? It's not exactly a beautiful memory, but it's profound, because I had this guy. His family was from Kenya, right? And in Kenya, because Kenya was also colonized by the British, so they have white owned farms. And so he had seen a horse before. I had never seen a horse, but I saw a comic book and had a horse, and they had cowboys and native Indians, but I didn't even know the dynamic at the time, because I was just they just looked cool that they were riding this animal that looked like a zebra, So I was like, wow, wait, how come the stripes are not there? Like, I was expecting it to be a zebra, but it's not a zebra, it's like brown, and one had like black and some. So I was fascinated. I wanted to draw that horse. And so this guy told me, if you want to learn how to draw this horse, you're going to have to give me half of your lunch every single day while we are in school. So I was like, man, I was desperate. I was like, okay, I'll give half of my lunch so I can get to learn how to. But he was really smart. So the
You
school that
got
I went
hustle.
to, yes, he hassled me, like, seriously. The school that I went to used to be a lake bed, right? So it dried out and they built the school, and the school is called Makonzi Boarding School. And at the time, it was actually in a danger zone because we were going through like wars in Uganda. And so our parents would send us off in a bus, and you go out there and you're just almost like isolated from, society. And so, but while I was there, he was smart, because there was all this sand in that school. So he would draw on the sand. He never drew on a piece of paper that I could carry with me and try to redraw. So he drew on the sand. Whenever he would finish drawing the head, he would kick the dirt and cover it up, and then said, "You gotta give me lunch again tomorrow." So that's
Man, mastermind.
Yes. So I'm thinking, man, you know what? I have a YouTube channel now, but if I did that to people, because it's like almost like instant, just like a disappearing YouTube, clip.
He kind of created Snapchat before it was Snapchat.
Like, seriously, it was incredible. Like I was like determined to learn how to draw a horse. Mm-hmm. But when I and so because of that mentality, I was like, okay, this guy is hustling me, and he's drawing piece by piece. He's never drawn he didn't draw the whole horse until the end of the year, and I didn't know anybody else who knew how to draw a horse in the school. He was the one that would show off what he had drawn, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I learned to memorize things. Mm. So when he would draw the head, I was like, okay, let me just not even say a thing. I'm just going to look at the head. So when he would leave, I'll go back and I'll try to find ways that he would to trace where he had gone. But that wasn't helpful enough. So I just have to draw it. So I learned how to draw horses and zebras, you know. And the funny thing is that in Uganda, when I first came to the US, guys would ask me, so have you ever seen a lion? I was like, have you ever seen a giraffe with your own eyes? I'm like, I've never actually seen a lion with my own eyes. Because mm-hmm. people think because you're from Africa, wildlife is just everywhere, you know? But that's not the case. We actually have to go to the national parks to see some of these animals, you know? So even for a zebra, I never could have done that because I didn't even know how to go to the national park at the time. Mm-hmm. My dad was, he had a hunting license. But the animal that I used to see, like he had a Uganda cob of some kind. Its head was almost like taxidermy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was mounted in the corridor of the home that we used to live. So that's the closest I had ever seen like a real wild animal up close. Yeah. It's crazy.
I feel like for me, in trying to, you know, be respectful of the continent and be like, okay, there's multiple countries. Let me try to learn about all these countries, and then trying to go to YouTube. And you type in like African stuff and it's just all animals. And I'm like, who is talking about the people?
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's what, so YouTube does that to you, doesn't it? Like the moment you search for something, it's going to recommend something similar to what you just searched for, right? Mm-hmm. And so for the longest time, I think because we didn't have access to the internet for a long time in Africa, you only had a database of Western culture, you know, if you search for something. It wasn't until Africans started taking pictures of like day-to-day life that you got like a variety of what life looks like in Africa. But for the most part, it was the people that came to visit Africa would take a picture and then go back and maybe share it on the internet. And that's all you knew about it. If they saw poverty, they took a picture of poverty. That's all you get access to when you search, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't until us as, you know, artists, African artists, started actually taking pictures of our environment, sharing it, creating African art and sharing it on the web that you got like a bigger pool to draw from. Yeah.
And now that I think about it, I feel like it makes sense because sometimes when I, I don't really watch TV that much, but when I used to watch TV and you see the like, 5 cents a day or 1 cent a day, but then they start doing it for animals. I'm like, there's people who will give it to an animal more than a human being. I believe that. And so it makes sense that they will only show animals. So can you talk like more about like the concept of the clans and what you can eat and stuff?
Oh my. But that's actually, it's has, I mean, I think the equivalent of that is the Native American culture, right? Mm-hmm. Each like tribe has like, they have totems that, you know, if you go like ego totem or bear totem and things like that. So in my culture, the largest tribe in Uganda is called the Baganda tribe, right? Mm-hmm. And in what we believe is that each person has, the way they structured it, and this was mainly to keep like a coherence of, to avoid intermarriages and things like that, is that they will give you a totem. So your clan would have a totem, and also your names would be, that you would have a set of names that belong to that particular clan, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have a totem, you are not allowed to eat that particular totem, right? Now, my totem, you know, funny enough, is called the edible rat, right? Mm-hmm. So I, even though they say it's an edible rat, I can't eat it. I don't think I want to eat it anyway.
Right. You know?
But it's this massive, like I said, a rat really, it's almost like it's probably as big as a cat, you know, sometimes they grow bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my totem. So they were trying, this is just me thinking, like, maybe they were trying to kind of encourage people to like wildlife conservation kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which tied into the culture part of it. But the king does not have a clan. We have a king and a queen, and they want to, the king couldn't have a clan, but the queen could be picked from any clan. So that's how the king would be able to create like a harmony that he would mm-hmm. marry from different tribes and clans. And that's how you get to where we are now. But you could, if you're in the buffalo clan, you're not allowed to eat a buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the crocodile clan, you're not allowed to eat a crocodile kind of thing. So that's that. It goes like that, like different, yeah. But it's pretty cool. It really
is. Yeah, it's so interesting. So what would you say is your favorite custom or tradition from your culture?
From Uganda, I think we have this term called Obuntubulam. And what that means is that you have to have the quality of being kind. You have to extend grace. You have mm-hmm. to be respectful to your elders. So everywhere you go, you're taught that you have to have Obuntubulam, which means that the way you treat people has to be like first and foremost paramount, because that's the way you're going to be able to navigate life. Like, if mm-hmm. you treat people the way you want to be treated. Now, I don't know if many people want to be treated in a mean way.
Right.
But you want to encourage people to be kind to others. But Uganda is such a diverse country. We have many, many tribes, but we're all united in one way or the other. I mean, there are some cases of political, you know, strife here and there and disagreements, but for the most part, the tribes, all the different tribes live in harmony. And it was actually by force. The missionaries came, and of course, after the missionaries came, then followed colonialism. So we were colonized by the British, and we were forced together as a group of tribes. We were forced to exist as a country right now, Uganda. And in spite of our differences, we are really coexisting in a peaceful way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your food and like also like the Indian influence of it and stuff?
So I think in terms of the Indian influences, and a lot of it comes from, again, history in terms of colonialism, because the British wanted to build a railway to take resources from the inland, the East African inland, all the way to the coast, the Indian Ocean, because they couldn't, it was too far to go to the West African coast, right? Mm-hmm. So they had to build a railway from Uganda to the coast. And that's how the Indians came to Uganda and the Arabs, because they brought them as laborers to work on the railway. Mm-hmm. And so they brought their families. So over a period of time, we had more and more, you know, Asian, East Asian communities coming in and bringing their families. And so wherever you go now, you'll find Indian families that actually speak our language really well. Like, they will speak mm-hmm. Uganda fluently, and mm-hmm. you'll be amazed. And so I think it's a known fact that Idi Amin Dada, who was a dictator at the time, who was mm-hmm. One of our presidents, kicked out all the Asians at one point. Mm. You know, so it created like the economy actually suffered as a result of that. I know he was doing it in terms of patriotism,
mm-hmm.
but you can't just kick people out who are part of your fabric in mm-hmm. terms of commerce, in terms of, so when the Indians came, they brought with them, you know, spices from India, spices from the Middle East. And so most of our food in Uganda is cooked with spices, you know, Indian spices. So our food tastes very similar when it comes to Indian food. So I love Indian food. Mm-hmm. I love spicy food for sure. Yeah, and that's how the most popular food in Uganda is matoke, which is mm-hmm. a type of banana. And we have a freshwater lake called Lake Victoria. So we eat a lot of fish. There's the Nile Perch, which is really, it can grow massive, like really, really big. And then we have tilapia and also catfish.
Okay. Yeah.
But for the most part, we eat yuca. I don't know if you've tested yuca. Like, I think in Jamaica, it's like a white tube, or like a root tuber looking kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
But it tastes really good to me, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were your parents supportive of your artistic interests?
Absolutely. Yeah. My dad, I think how I got into computers is one day my dad took a trip to the US and he came back with this XT computer. I think at the time it had like, I don't know if it was 640 KB of memory, and you had to use a floppy disk to make it start. And it was DOS. There was a time when it was DOS 5 and it updated to DOS 6.2. So that's how I got into computers. But I learned how to program using QBasic. My brothers and I mean, we just dug into that computer. It was black and I think it was like an orange tint. At one point, we had a monitor that was green. So I had no idea of color in terms of designing on the computer. Everything was black and white. That's how you design like monochromatic. But we loved it. And we had a friend of ours. His name is Duncan. And he's like one of my favorite neighbors. We used to escape from our home, run to over to the neighbor just to play his, because they had a different kind of computer that I just brought in. And it had two floppy disks. And they had a Commander, there's like a Ranger game that they had installed. And I fell in love with video games because of that game. It was like a almost like isometric view game. That's how you played it. But it had like multiple levels where you had the your parachute into the parachute into the terrain, and then you have to fight your way up different levels. We love the game. Absolutely love the game. That's a, and so my dad supported us through making sure that we had access to things like that, but it also it was upon us to really dig into it. My brother and these three brothers, we would just share whatever we learned. In terms of art, it wasn't until later on, I think, in my we have the different structure in terms of education system. It's structured like the UK, like the British system. So we have primary school, and then we have secondary. So I think, I don't know what the equivalent is here, but from senior one to senior four, so you join the school when you're about 13 years old. By senior four, you're about like 13, 14, 15, you're about 16, 17 over there. And then the last 2 years of secondary, you're about 17 and 18. So maybe it's the same equivalent to being a junior and a senior, here in the US.
Yeah, I feel like maybe primary would be elementary school and then secondary would be middle school and high school.
Exactly. And so that's how we got into, learning the like the practical part of it. We were taught in school, but my parents introduced us to computers at an early age. But because we really didn't have TV throughout the entire day. TV came out around 6 o'clock. So at 6 o'clock in the evening, we were all lined up, sitting in front of this black and white TV, waiting for the TV to turn on. And when it came on, we had maybe like 3 hours of it, and then they turned it off, and that's it. So all you had was this small window to dream, to get an insight. And I love music right now, and I played in a band for about 6 years, but I fell in love with guitar because of the Grand Ole Opry. They used to reruns, that's how I got into seeing how they played the banjo and lead guitar and things like that. So it's amazing with the things that like how we get into the industry.
So, like, after being hustled, how did you continue to grow as an artist throughout your
Okay.
like
Yeah. So the one thing that happened to me, and I consider this a blessing, is that during my senior six vacation, so this is a secondary school, you finish secondary school, you're in your vacation waiting to go to university, right? Usually you get that long vac it's almost like summer vacation. But during that vacation, I happened a cousin of mine was working for an Indian gentleman called Arnu Govindi, and he had like a photo studio developing photos, but he also sold APCs around Kampala. He wanted to start a like to get more traffic into his photo studio. So he told my cousin, I'm looking for an artist to paint a mural. So I was hired, I painted the mural, and at the end of finishing the mural, he noticed that traffic was coming, more traffic was coming to his shop because people could see the mural from a long way off. And then so he offered me, he said, man, are you interested in computers at all, in computer graphic design? I was like, I don't know what that is. He said, well, it's creating art on the computer because I see you're an artist. And he said, well, I can give you a deal whereby I'm not going to pay you, right? But I can teach you in the evenings. You do for me the work during the day, and then in the evening I'll pass on this, like industry training. I was like, so I got in the taxi, went all the way home. I was covered in paint, told her, shared with my family, and I had to make a decision. So the next day I was like, okay, you know what? Let me see what this is about. Maybe when like a week in, I'll jump out, you know? So he took me on a journey for 6 months. Of course, I never jumped out. After 6 months, I just dived in. He had Photoshop. I think it was on Windows 3.1 at the time. And we didn't even have a mouse. I was using the keyboard like in Paint. I don't know if people even know now that Windows has a Paint program in it.
Yeah.
Like a free Paint program. So that's how I got into art, using Paint and using the keyboard and arrow keys, like almost like stapling, you know, like just painting, using the brush. That's how I got into computer design and computer graphics as an early entrant, like at the time. But it took me realizing what a great opportunity this was, that I was willing not to get paid, but let's get the knowledge to be able to do, to get trained by this gentleman. And so soon after that is when I got the scholarship to come to the US to do a degree in fine art. But that education that gentleman passed on to me, that industry training, gave me such a huge head start, because once I got to the US, I could have skipped a lot of the classes,
yeah,
you know, because of the training that I got, and it actually accelerated. So I did an accelerated Associate of Applied Science in Computer Animation at Montgomery College, then transferred, started working full-time attached to a defense contractor, and then went to George Mason University and did a BA in Art and Visual Technology. But the foundation was in that back room of that Indian gentleman.
Nice. I remember when I was living in New Orleans, and this lady wanted me to try to teach kids animation at Warren Houston High School. And I remember I had created a flyer, and then all they had access to on the computer was MS Paint, and I had to change the flyer. And that was the worst thing I've ever experienced in life. To like, I've created this flyer in like either Adobe Illustrator or Photoshop, and then happened to change like a date or something in MS Paint. I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. So yeah.
Yeah, kids nowadays, kids don't understand, you know, the struggles in the training.
And then now they got the little 3D version of Paint on computers, so that's cool. So like from seeing these planes from far, like to being on a plane, like how was that experience?
It was weird. It was like so strange, because when I got to the airport, first of all, I didn't even know if I had to pay for the food on the plane. You know, that was like foreign to me. I'm like, okay, do I even have enough to go? And I'd had horror stories. They say that once you get to the plane, you're going to throw up because it's going to lift up so quick. Everything is going to pour out. You know, I was scared.
Right.
I was scared to get on a plane. And so, but I was blessed. So my journey coming to the US is incredible, because there was a lady, her name is Hazel Collett, and she was our principal in the UK at the time. And she had come to Uganda to just track the mountain gorillas, because she loved wildlife. And also, she also had a passion for helping orphans. But on the day, so I get the scholarship, right? And I get a visa. It's an I-20 visa to come to the US to do my art degree. And so I thought that they had actually given me a full scholarship, but it wasn't a full scholarship. So I get to the US, but on my way to the US, I didn't have the money for the ticket. You know, a gentleman came in, his name is Joseph Semwogere. He had a business that he was starting in Uganda at the time. And he offered me a deal, like, if you can train my employees here to use these computers, I'll help fund your ticket to the US. And he did. He was very kind about that. But on the way to the airport, I knew, first of all, I told my parents, I'm going to the US. I don't know what I'm going to encounter, but I don't want to take any luggage. So I came to this country with one pair of pants, one shirt, a backpack, my poetry book, because I used to write poems. And I wish I could have brought my guitar when I was, because I love playing guitar at the time. I was part of a worship team in a church. And so I get to the airport. My parents bid me farewell, like, you know, we're going to be praying for you wherever you're going. They were like, but you're not taking anything. I was like, you know what? I know God is going to provide for me once I get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I get in line. I have all these fears about flying. I was very nervous about even sharing something on the counter, because in Africa, men don't usually share their fears, you know, their mm-hmm. concerns. It's like, yeah. you're a man right now, so you know what to do. But I honestly didn't know what to do. So I talked to the lady at the counter, said, you know what, I need help. I have never been on a plane before. I am terrified. And so the lady that I'm talking about, Hazel, was about maybe like 10 people behind me. The reason she was at the airport, and this is wild, this is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The reason she was at the airport, she had a dream, you know, the night before, that she had to be on a specific flight out of Entebbe Airport. And she didn't know why, right? So mm-hmm. I'm on my way to the US. I am on a faith journey. I don't know. I was, at the time, I was just a young Christian at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's okay to talk about faith on that channel. Okay.
This is about you.
Yes, I was on a faith journey coming to the US, and I was like, okay, if they say that God is actually faithful, I really want to experience that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know he's put something in me. He has given me this talent. He's taking me to the US. There has to be a reason, because I didn't ask for this talent. I can only tell you that I was born as an artist. I could draw from a very early age. I could create so many things that other kids couldn't do. And so I knew there was a reason why I was created a certain way. And so mm-hmm. me coming to the US, I could see the journey starting to evolve. I'm like, maybe God is taking me somewhere for a reason. So I get into the line. I share with this lady that I am scared. So Hazel is what I was listening back there. And I think at that point is when she made the connection. Maybe I'm supposed to help this young man.
Mm-hmm.
So I go through security and she follows me and comes and talks, asks me, are you hungry? And at the time, I didn't have any money. Any money whatsoever at the time. I had maybe like, I think Ghana shillings to pay taxes. I think it was 10,000 or 20,000 Ugandan shillings at the time. You had to pay tax at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I was able to do. And so when I sat down, I was like, okay, I'm hungry, man. And I remember someone had told me, like, you know, if you really want to know that God is faithful, just ask, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was praying. I was like, God, you know, you say, don't worry, you feed the ravens, you feed you clothe the lilies and whatever. I am hungry right now.
Mm-hmm.
The lady walks up to me and asks me, are you hungry? I was like, oh my gosh. And she says she has 5,000 Ugandan shillings that she couldn't, she was going back to the UK. She wasn't going to be able to use it. So she handed it to me. And that's when my faith journey began. It's like, mm-hmm. okay. So we talked, we sat and talked. She asked me about my background. She asked me, do you love music? I told her that I love music. She said, but where's your luggage? I said, the one thing that I wish I could have brought is a guitar. And I wish I could have brought my art supplies. So on our way, she told me, don't worry about, because I had a seat next to a gentleman, gentleman, I think he was a tourist,
mm-hmm.
and she asked him, can we switch seats, right? So she came and sat in the seat where he was, and he was like, she gave up a window seat so he could, and he was like, he was happy to go. So she sat down and said, she told me, this is what you need to do, Solomon, that since you have a layover in Brussels, make sure you, whatever perishables are, pack them in a bag, you know. So my prayer was, please, God, bring someone who can help me figure out all this. And this lady is sitting right there,
yeah,
helping me. And so, man, that journey took us to, I went to Brussels, had the 8-hour layover, she had a 4-hour layover. I shared with her about my love for music. So she bought me a guitar. She gave me her phone number and said, if you ever need someone to touch and talk to, here's my number. So I get to Boston. I call the school up and they ask me, why aren't you at the school? I'm like, what do you mean? Just they said, don't you know that you're late? That we are required to report to the INS, which is immigration,
mm-hmm.
that you're not in school right now. So make sure you get to the airport as soon as you can. I said, but I don't have a ticket. They said, you got to figure something out. And they mm-hmm. asked me, they told me, did you bring the money for tuition? I was like, what money? I thought you gave me a scholarship. They said, it wasn't a full scholarship. I was like, oh my God. So, and at the time, I thought, like, they were talking about $5,000 per mm-hmm. semester. And I was calculating in my mind, because this is 1996.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago. And the dollar to the Uganda exchange rate was big. It's huge. That's like thousands and thousands and thousands of Ugandan shillings that you had to come up with, if not millions. Actually, millions, more like me. A lot of millions of Ugandan shillings. So I just, the only person that I could reach out to was this lady. So I call her up and say, man, this is the situation. So she told me, I'll be praying for you. The next morning, I get a phone call from the school. They say, why are you not at the airport? I'm like, what do you mean? They said, someone has paid for your ticket. He's waiting for you. You have to go to the airport. And I said, but you told me to bring the tuition. They said, no, all your tuition is paid until you graduate.
Oh, someone wow.
Someone has paid for your books or everything that you're going to need. Someone has paid for it. So this lady had paid for my everything that I was ever going to need. And so she invested in my art education at a very, very early stage. I had my coming to America story kind of thing, you know. And I was like, if I don't.
Yours is better.
You know, if I'd never see this lady again, I thought I would have met an angel. But fast forward to today, as we speak, Hazel is now a permanent resident in Uganda, right? And the story of her wanting to, her love for helping others actually resulted into us building a school in Uganda, in Bushenyi, in the western part of Uganda. And the school is catering for over 900 students right now, coming to 1,000. And about over 60% of them either are orphans and need help, and over 50% are actually girls. So they get free education as a result, because a lot of the children in this area, either their parents have died because of AIDS, you know, or they just their grandparents are taking care of them. It's like just feeling a need in that area. And I'd promise myself that, you know, whenever God brings me to the US, one thing that I have to do is make sure I give back to my country. So it just warms my heart whenever I get a report that the numbers are growing in the school. So it started off with just a primary school. Then we built a technical school right now. So kids can learn how to tailor, how to do like gardening and things like that. And Hazel has been there all the way through. So that investment that she put in, you know, the first thing that I actually do, I had to design the website, the logo for the organization. It's called jjcityuganda.org. And that has been my journey of, yes, I needed, I knew I was created for a reason, but I realized that when I create art, it has to be art that actually makes a difference.
Yeah. That is wonderful. I know when I lived in South Korea and I went from, I got in touch with an animation company, and then, you know, I have the whole story kind of in a video, but like they ended up offering me the position. And I remember sitting in the chair, like, you know, because when you teach English, they provide your apartment. And so I just was like, oh, where am I going to live? But I personally felt well, I mean, God wouldn't give me this if I could, if it wasn't going to happen, if it wasn't going to be figured out. So I just said,
yes. Did you have any, like, what was your experience in terms of language barrier? Was there like, did you speak Korean?
No, like by the time I left Korea, they called me Hanguk Saram, which means Korean person. So I could pronounce the heck out of Korean, but I don't know that much. I've always actually been good at languages and pronunciation. Yeah. I feel like I try harder than the average American to pronounce things right. I remember even when I was first learning Korean, I kind of felt bad because I was trying to pronounce it well, but I felt like I was making fun of them. But then I kind of got through that block or whatever. And so I was able to pronounce it really, really well. And once I worked at the animation company, like my department, the 3D department, was very small, and like nobody could really speak fluent English, and I couldn't speak fluent Korean, but we made it work because it's art. So it's just very interesting how you can make it work without knowing each other's language. Like I would just try to use, like, you know, Korean and English to talk to them, and they try to use Korean and English to talk.
I struggled when I came to the US because we were using what we call Queen's English. And so I did an honors class in English, and they kept marking some of my things wrong because I had, for example, color, you know.
Color, you are.
Right? Like that's like, the guy, they would cross out the U. I'm like, what's up with that? You know, that's the correct way of spelling it. And it came from the Queen. This guy's invented English. Come on. So words like endeavor, you know, like there was like some words that were just not the same.
Yeah.
American English. And I remember being, I attended Ohio Valley University. That's where I actually met my wife. Mm-hmm. I met her by a vending machine. And I could have sworn the vending machine was a robot, because I'm into sci-fi.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I'm coming to the first world country. Everything is going to be like robots everywhere. They're going to be like things that are going to be, you talk to it and can serve you and things like that. So once I got to that school, I woke up to this. I was really hungry at the time. And that's after I got the ticket, by the way, after I got that phone call. So uh-huh. I ended up at the school the very first day of meeting. It was Ohio Valley University. And I go to this vending machine. I didn't know it was a vending machine at the time. So I put in some money in it. I wanted some ice cream.
Uh-huh.
You know, it looked like it yummy over there. So I then spoke to it. I want some ice cream. And it did not respond to me. I was like, is it my accent? You know, is it not understanding what I'm saying? Are you understanding the words that are coming out of my mouth kind of moment? But it did not. And then my wife was watching me from back there. And they had heard that this foreign student was coming to the university from Africa.
Uh-huh.
So I think she took pity on me. And so she came over and said, what is it that you need? It's like, I'm just speaking to this robot, but it's not doing anything to me. You know, it's supposed to give me. And she's like, that's not a robot. That is a vending machine. So she took some money and put it in. She was able to get something. And when I turned around, I saw her eyes, and it was love at first sight. I was like, we met at a vending machine. That was love at first sight. But I really thought it was going to be a robot.
You thought you were in a Jetsons.
You know, it was the first world. It was America.
Right.
Thankfully, you know, that actually worked out, because that's how I met my wife, you know.
Yeah. I feel like, man, your steps were so ordered.
I'm telling you, it was so crazy, because even the way I was supposed to arrive here, so Hurricane Eduardo hit New England at the time, and they flew the planes out of Logan Airport, you know. So my flight was actually, I was like, I mean, I'm supposed to be at the school. But because the flights were not there, I had to take a flight the next day. And mm-hmm. my wife was supposed to work at the student center the previous day. So they switched out, and she ended up being there on the very day that my flight was switched out. That's how we met. And when I met her, I was like, okay, I'm going to go sit down, and I'm going to tell, I told Gajin, well, I've been patient, because throughout high school, I'd never really dated, because mm-hmm. I was waiting for that person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, she got to be the one. She's got to be the one. And I had no idea about the etiquette with African-American women and Black guys. I had no idea. So uh-huh. I was like, okay, let me pray to God. If she comes to me and says these exact words, I'm going to know she's the one that I'm going to marry. So I waited and said, come on, God, she's not coming. She's not moving. And then eventually she got up. You know, after she had helped me with the food from the vending machine, she actually went back and sat down with her friends over in a corner. Mm-hmm. And then I went and sat by myself and enjoyed my whatever I got from the vending machine. Mm-hmm. But now here I was like, and I want her to come talk to me. So she eventually came over and she said the exact words that I had prayed for. And then I told her, you're going to be my wife. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And she said, okay, can we reset this right here? You know, she sat down and we just had a conversation. And then, so I was like, okay, I didn't know how long I was going to be at this school.
Yeah.
Right. Because I'd asked around and they told me they didn't have animation, because I went on the plane, on the flight, it was a Sabina flight from Brussels to Boston. They had this thing, because I'd never seen animation before, like 3D animation.
Mm-hmm.
But on those little screens on the back of the, you know, seats in the plane, something was playing and it looked human, but it wasn't 2D, you know, because I'd seen animated cartoons, right, in 2D, but I'd never really seen like a 3D animated cartoon. So I had this character flying through. And now when I look back, I'm thinking that had to be Poser. You know, someone mm-hmm. must have used Poser to create that program, now that I remember the characters.
Yeah.
So I looked at that and was like, when I get to the school, I'm going to ask. So once I got to Ohio Valley University, I asked them, you know, there's something that I saw on the plane. What was it? It looked like characters moved, but it wasn't human. they said, oh, you're interested in 3D animation. We don't do, we don't offer 3D animation here. So I ended up transferring from that university to Montgomery College, which is a community college in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I knew I was just there for a brief moment, I was like, okay, let me write my wife. Well, she wasn't my wife at the time. Let me write her a letter and I'm going to tell her everything that I feel about her. Because when I told her that she was going to be my wife, she had like this deathly look come over her. And she had actually gone back and told her mom that this black guy, this African guy told me I was going to be his wife. And so I think the I don't know what kind of conversation was had, but I think they told, they essentially, now that I know about stalkers, right, I would have done it differently. In the US, you don't do that. You know, you just don't do that. And so even because in the Uganda, for example, when you see a little kid,
mm-hmm.
they talk about differences in culture. When you see a little kid, it's very easy for you to go and say, oh, you're so cute, and touch them, pinch their cheeks and things like that. I tried that out in the mall. I saw a little girl and I was like, oh man, she's so beautiful. And I was reaching out. The parents yanked the kid and they looked at me like, are you crazy? I'm like, but you know,
right.
I was just complimenting the baby, you know, you just don't. So there are things that I didn't know about American culture.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, I did not know because had I known, I would have probably not been brave enough to say the thing. So I wrote a letter to her. I told her, you know, this, I have nothing on me right now. Mm-hmm. I only have one pair of pants and one shirt and this backpack. That's all I'm bringing to the table. But I feel like we together can make a great life together. We can start out and we can build that. And so I said, it'll be awesome. Because I said, I truly believe that you're going to be my wife. So I gave her the letter. The next day, I walk into the student center. And I feel like the whole section of girls were looking at me. I was like, why are they staring? Why are they staring at me? So I felt like I wanted the ground to just swallow me because, first of all, I was already shy by nature. I'm an introvert. I like people staring at me.
Right.
Just scared and creeped me out. And so when I saw like girls snickering and laughing and looking at me like they know something that I don't, terrified. I was just terrified. So I went and sat down and then I found out that my wife, well, my future wife, had shared the letter I'd written to her with her friends.
Uh-huh.
And everyone knew exactly what I had written. And so, so we played like, where she would see me in a corridor, she would run the other way. And then I'll try to find strategic places where I could actually see her and meet her, you know, without being stalkerish.
Right.
You know? But it turned out that, you know, after a while, we got to know each other and she actually bought me, because once she realized that I only had those two items, she was kind enough to go to a mall and come back with all kinds of things that she had shopped. And I think she had worked for a shoe company at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Payless, I believe that was the name. And so she brought me some shoes, and when she gave me all those things, like, ah, she loves me. She was just playing hard to get. But that's how our journey began, you know, because I was convinced that the way God had ordered my footsteps, that this was part of that journey, that I'd met the, you know, the love of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got married in 2000, and we've been married coming 22 years now.
Nice.
We have two kids, you know, that are just beautiful, a son and a daughter. And actually, we just celebrated her sweet 16th birthday. Mm-hmm. But through it all, my wife has been there encouraging me to pursue my, you know, my dream of using art to tell stories and things like that. Yeah.
That is a wonderful, wonderful start to being in America.
Yeah. My American journey, coming to America.
Right.
Yeah.
Now that needs to be the movie.
Now I'm not a, I told her I'm not a king. That's a reminder.
Not a prince, not a king. No, no. To warn you.
I do have a little bit of royalty in my past, because my great grandfather was a chief. Actually, my grandfather was a chief. So that's how we end up. Well, I think we got the land that we have right now in the village, because his grandfather, I think, had fought on the side of the British during the First World War or Second World War, one of the two. So they, those who fought on the side of the king and helped, you know, they were rewarded as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we, but I wasn't, and no, I'm not a king. It's like, I don't have a kingdom.
Right.
Yeah, no.
So
we built everything from scratch.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your project in Kosa Anantcha?
Yes. So you remember you asked me a question about language.
Yes.
And the impact of the missionary schools, you know. So this particular Nkosa Anantcha project was actually it was the fruit of that exercise of trying to create something. And my wife is African-American, and me being Ugandan, we are so multicultural. So my wife was trying to find a way to learn a little bit about my culture so she could pass on. You know, so our kids are homeschooled. They were homeschooled for about, coming to 12 years. So she homeschooled them for 6 years, and then she got a job, and then I homeschooled them for the next 6 years as well. So we just balanced out. But one of those things that we were trying to do is find a way to introduce them to my culture.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, it started off as just me trying to create something for my kids and my wife. But the more I interacted with the families in the diaspora, especially those from Uganda, I realized that more and more parents were looking for resources, you know, especially as children, because we believe in, like, you know how they say in Africa, it takes a village to raise a child. We yes. truly believe in that kind of community part, or Ubuntu kind of community mm-hmm. Aspect. And so I was trying to find a way, how can I help parents who are struggling right now? Because if you don't get a child when they're young, when you're teaching them a language, you know, it's that there's like a formative, it's like window where the child can actually learn the language effortlessly. And so that's how I came up with Nkosa Anantcha, to provide a fun way to learn the language. Because even back then, when we were learning the different languages in Uganda, it was mostly from textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing really visual about it. And this, certainly the auditory part of it was from teachers. Once mm-hmm. the teacher left, that was it, right? And so even now in Uganda, parents are struggling with their kids not speaking our own languages because of the English and the Western kind of education that has been, you know, become an influence in Uganda. And so the Nkosa Anantcha app has like this, like a free section for teaching languages, introduction to Swahili, Luganda. And we have like other languages that have not yet activated. That's the main focus of it, is that how can I help parents in the diaspora to celebrate our cultural heritage and languages using art and animation to convey mm-hmm. that story. Yeah.
So how are your children at Luganda?
That's one of the challenges. That, like, whenever I talk to a parent, I tell them, please, please, whatever you do, start them young.
Mm-hmm.
I drop the ball, you know, because I worked in the gaming industry for like 15 years. And you know how demanding it can be when deadlines, because I would come home sometimes at midnight when you have to churn out a build. If the texture maps are not done, if, you know, the animation clips are not in place, you had to work late hours. And because I was working in the defense industry, there's a different level of like expectation there. You know, military circles, you say you're going to deliver something, you have to deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a fun industry to work in. But it's also demanding. Just like, again, it was a gaming studio, but creating a game for the military, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it really took time away from me spending time with my kids. And actually, that's why we agreed with my wife to homeschool our kids. And when we got married, we waited 5 years before having kids, because, like, you know, let's get to know each other.
Because mm-hmm.
once the kids come,
right,
it's going to be a different, you know, challenge altogether. So I mean, it's not always possible, but when mm-hmm. I talk to young couples, I'm always encouraging them, telling them, you know what, take a year, please
mm-hmm.
learn each other, because once the child comes, your whole world is going to revolve around that child. And you didn't even get a chance to know each other as married, you know,
right.
as a married couple. And so with those 5 years, we took time to learn each other, trying to do things that we wouldn't have done if we were married, right? And then once the kids came, our whole focus changed to, okay, let's homeschool them for those first 6 years. And then once my wife got a job, she's a teacher. She's mm-hmm. been teaching for over almost close to 20 years as well. And so that's, and she's, so her input has been incredible. You know, it's like her, being married to her has taught me to appreciate kids in a different way. And you know, there's a way that women see children that we guys don't just see. It's just totally different. There's like instinct, you know. I have to learn my kids, but for her, the kids always run to mommy, you know. When they come to you as a dad, it's like a, usually do you have money, you know, where can you take me to the mall, you know, kind of thing. But homeschooling my kids just gave me an opportunity for those 6 years to just be their friend. So our kids were animation heavy in terms, they didn't really do math a lot because we're just creating. We had pipe cleaners building cars and characters, and they, at the end of each semester, they would actually do a presentation of an animation that they created. They had a video that they had captured, a craft that they had created, you know, an Iron Man suit that they had made up with out of boxes and things like that. When we bought something, boxes became vehicles. Like our whole life changed because we made sure that they had this like infusion of creativity before all the other mundane things came in that this public school system was going to force on them. And I think they, as a result of that, they are way more grounded, and they're leaning more and more towards their creative side. My son has a YouTube channel where he actually creates those like pipe cleaners, and this is like one of the probably the top 100 in the world in terms of pipe cleaner creations. And that started because of that homeschooling journey. And my daughter also has her own YouTube channel. So things that I never had access to, these kids are really taking advantage of it, yeah, and having fun with that.
Wonderful. So you won several awards for the Adventures of Inkosa and
Yes.
Nansha. How does it feel to be recognized for your work?
I think more than anything, it's the team recognition. Because you when you're in the trenches, you know the struggles that you go through. Because as a business owner, my wife and I, we started our Soul Studios, because and I always tell artists, there's gonna come a time when art, you have to understand that art is also a business. If you don't understand business, you're not gonna, you know, progress very much as an artist. Because I thought that you could be an artist, make money, just, you know, freely enjoy it. I did not realize you had to pay taxes, you had to, you know, business taxes and business licenses, and so much goes into it. I thought you could just a successful artist that I'd seen, but I didn't realize what business aspect, you know, that aspect of business that was required. So when we started the business, we had to find a team. We had to build a team. But for the longest time, when I was creating Koza and Nancha, it was just a one-man team, you know. But as a one-man team, you can create great things, but you can't make a lot of progress. You can make progress over years, you know, until you get like a team. Like I remember what being inspired by James Cameron, it took him 10 years, 10 to 11 years to do the first Avatar. It wasn't because he couldn't, but it was because the technology hadn't caught up to his dream. You know, he had to build a team just to invent some of the cameras that they were needed, that to, you know, for even motion capture by itself hadn't matured to the level that it has now. And so when I get recognized, when we get an award for like Nkoza and Nancha, it's like, man, this is for the team. Because we've been working on this. I know what I've done in the past, but these guys have helped me bring it to the level where it is right now.
Why do you like Avatar so much? What is the meaning of it for you?
So, one of the things that I am passionate about is wildlife conservation, right? Stay with me. Wildlife conservation. And one of the things that I've actually championed was the conservation of the mountain gorillas. My first film, my first animated film, 3D animated film, is it was called The Adventures of, it was the Galiwango or Ulamu Wekisode, which is translated in English means the life of a gorilla. I have had this dream for the longest time. The film is not even complete yet. But it's a passion project because I wanted to inform the young generation in Uganda to conserve our beauty, our natural beauty, because at the time when I did that, I started working on the film, there were only like 720 mountain gorillas left in the entire world. And so I embarked on this journey, and this was even before Dawn of the Planet of the Apes came out, right? Mm-hmm. I'd wanted to make an animated mountain gorilla that spoke my language, that would share the struggles it was experiencing to the humans because of a language. So let me not give it away, because that's the plot.
Yes. But
that's the film. It's that this mountain gorilla that's learned how to speak. And so it has parallels with Avatar, because the mountain gorillas live in a part of what they call the Bwindi Impenetrable Forest in southwestern Uganda, the border between Congo and Rwanda, right? Mm-hmm. That's the only place where mountain gorillas can even exist. And so, or survive, rather. And so when I watched Avatar, I could see the parallels, because the mountain gorillas, they had to be protected, right? But in order for them to be protected, they had to kick out the natives who lived in that area. Mm. And they're called the Batwa.
Mm-hmm.
They're the Batwa tribes. They are given a name called the Pygmies because of their stature.
Mm-hmm.
But their cultural name is the Batwa, and they were kicked out and they started living on the outskirts of the impenetrable forest. And they were used to a life where they lived in balance with nature. They knew when to hunt, how much to hunt, and not like just hunt for the sake of sport, right?
Yeah.
But then they were stripped of that ability to balance that. So when I watched Avatar, I could see the Na'vi struggling, because of course this guy, the humans found, you know, these resources over there, and they were like, we want those resources, you know, therefore we're going to displace you because we want those resources. So that's why it tugged at the strings of my artistic intellect. It's like, man, this speaks so much to what the Batwa are going through,
right?
And so that's the story that I'm trying to tell through the Galwango film. And seeing that they were using motion capture, I made my own head mounted camera rig. I took my guitar stand, ripped it up, went to I think dollar store, found some parts, and I was able to make my first head mounted camera rig, because I'd seen it mm-hmm. being used. But I was like, man, I can't afford this. It's probably thousands and thousands of dollars. What mm-hmm. can I do on my own? So I made my own head mounted camera rig, and I was fortunate enough to partner with Mixamo at the time. Mm-hmm. Mixamo was this was before Adobe bought Mixamo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a gentleman called Nathan Ajello. He works for Tech2 right now, but he was the motion capture director at Mixamo. And so we partnered with them. I was able to create a show reel for them for their out of that, in exchange for the services. They took me, I flew to California, mm-hmm. San Francisco for 3 days, and they gave me access to their motion capture volume. And I was able to capture the mock-up that I needed for Galiwango. Yeah, it's a long story, but Avatar is in there somewhere.
Yeah, I've been, you know, following you for years. I don't even know how many at this point, but I also always see you, like, I now know the context of your passion for tech, but yeah. Also you are always trying to figure out, oh, how can I get 3D to go through this device? And you're always trying out new software. So what is the passion behind that?
So I've been a tinkerer for a long time, because even when I was in Uganda, I used to create my own transmitter. Again, it's like this passion to learn. Once I left that boarding school that I told you about with the horse guy, mm-hmm. the horse artist, I went to another boarding school, and this is called Budo. So I was in Budo Junior School, and then after Budo Junior School, that's where I had that experience with the Luganda, us being punished for speaking our cultural languages, our native languages. Then I went to the secondary extension of Budo Junior School, which is King's College Budo. While at King's College Budo, there was a gentleman, his name is Isaiah Mbuga. He was a senior at the time, no, senior four. And I used to walk by his cubicle, and I would see him working on something, and it looked fascinating. So it was a transmitter. The guy had created his own radio station, you know, and I'm like, how do you even do that? You know? So I would go, like, in the evenings after school, like after our classes, I would run and I would sit outside his cubicle. He probably thought I was like a crazy thing. But I was just passionate about learning. So I watched him. I asked him, can you please teach me how you made this transmitter? Because I see you transmitting and I can actually hear your music, because we had like different dormitories across the hill. Mm-hmm. And he on Saturdays, he would transmit music. And I was like, that is just so cool. I want to be able to do that. So if I wasn't an animator, I think I would have ended up becoming an electro engineer. Mm-hmm. And one of my passions, actually, I wanted to go to be an astronaut. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted Elon Musk, what he's doing right now. I'm like, man, I'm so much older, but I wish I was young. I could have gone to space. My wife told me, nah, you can go to space now. But I've always
wanted to go. No SpaceX for you.
No. We have kids. Yeah. So, but I wanted to be an astronaut. And part of that was just being able to communicate, you know, finding a way of telling story. Because I was like, man, it would be cool to tell our story here on Earth to other, you know, like civilizations out there. And I was like, radio frequencies, that would be a cool way to do it, you know. So it was all related about tinkering, being able to create things. So when I see technology that enables me to communicate a story, mm-hmm. it takes me back to my childhood of how I wanted to learn how to make a transmitter. And I actually succeeded in making, I was able to find like an old TV, take out the transistors and put out the, you know, solder some of those pieces together, find the speaker, connect the connections. And so it's, for me, I'm always trying to figure out how can I actually do this. And then when I figure it out, I want to share it.
Yeah.
And the guys, guess what? You can actually do this, you know, yourself. You don't even have to have a huge budget. You as a storyteller, where you are right now, but I know we all have dreams and we want to be able to create big budget films. But where you are right now, there's something you could actually do to bring your story to life. So that's that's my passion. Yeah.
Yeah, before I took my first animation course in high school, I was on my way to become an electrical engineer. I was on the robotics team, actually.
Wow.
And built a robot for FIRST Robotics. So, but then I found animation. I was like, well, bye.
Hey, you can still animate robots, right?
Actually, I ended up kind of, when I worked for the state of Louisiana, I did a lot of industrial manufacturing stuff. Yeah. So I did like gears and animating gears and machinery and stuff like that. Yeah. So, kind
of. Yeah. So there was in terms of, for example, just to pick up on that part of robotics. Mm-hmm. So because I grew up in a big family, you know, 8 sisters and the 3 brothers from my dad's side, it was such a big family that it's just too expensive to pay, mm-hmm. buy toys for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. So I learned how to make my own toys as a result of that. So that's again the tinkerer in me, is that my sisters, if they didn't have a doll, and strip off like these banana fibers and make dolls for them. So that's how I got into character modeling. You know, I was like, I've been creating characters for my sisters through fibers and things like that. So when I get into 3D, it was a natural transition, because I was to sell my own paintings in Uganda and also my sculptures. And I think, I mean, it all came full circle for me once I learned how to do ZBrush, mm-hmm. you know, and now I can sculpt in VR on the Quest 2 without being tethered to something. It's like, man, it's like a sculptor's dream. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you mentioned like pushing through, like, so, and to share, that's kind of why I learned stuff too. But like, also before Blender 2.8, you know, Blender was a struggle for me.
Yeah.
And so the only reason I was continuing to try to learn Blender is so I could share it with other people, because it was open source and free and I wanted to give access to, you know, Black and brown kids.
Yeah.
But if I didn't have the passion to share, I would have gave up a long time ago.
And the thing is, when you learn how to do something, if you teach yourself and you share it, it's much easier to do it again and again and again. You know, mm-hmm. and I think that's the best way for children to learn how to do, is to teach them how to do something so they can teach others. They will not forget that thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So what outlet does playing your guitar provide for you? I know you said you were in a band.
Yes. So music to me it's like there's something that I tap into inside that I can't paint with colors, you know? So I see music visually, actually. And when I used to watch those people playing on the Grand Ole Opry, it was black and white. You know, I wasn't paying attention to color or anything, but it was the music that came through that made me feel a certain way. So music has a way of just changing people, you know? Like I love reggae music, and Bob Marley's music has been a great influence in my life, and Jamaican music, and also Ugandan music and drums and things like that. So it's always finding a way. Again, it's storytelling in a way, but with through a different medium.
That's why you call it music doodles.
It is. It actually is. And I think playing reggae music for me, so whenever I hear a song, I reggaeify it. Like, when I hear Beyonce singing a song, like Single Ladies, I'm like, reggae version of Single Ladies, please. You know, and that's that. So when I created that MetaHuman music video with the No MetaHuman, No Cry,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that particular part of it. Is that, okay, I know Bob Marley, you know, wrote and played No Woman, No Cry. But I hear, so there were a lot of people at the time that were complaining about metahumans, you know. I was like, how do I actually channel that as a story? Right. Like, even if you're not a metahuman, you don't need to cry, right? So in the audience, if you notice, there are actor core characters. They're not metahumans. And they're just jamming away. Like, you know, they're not metahumans, so no need to cry. So that's, I'm always thinking about, how can I tell the story in a different way that can appeal to people and capture the message in a specific moment in time? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So music to me is a channel of another way of telling stories, but also it's a spiritual journey as well, because I use it to like in worship and things like that. And I used to play music for my kids. You know, I just love music as well. Yeah. And so a lot of my animations, I try to infuse music as much as possible in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What have you learned throughout your life and career that would be beneficial advice to others?
Not to speak ill of other people. Because my goodness, you don't realize that the next door you knock on, that will be someone that you may have talked about, you know, to somebody else. And to always extend grace, because you are going to be in a position of leadership someday. And because I set off as a junior animator, you know, and I remember being impatient with my art directors. You know, I was like, man, I know better than them. I can do better than them. I can draw better than them. Mm-hmm. Why don't they take my idea? But yeah. Now I'm a creative director, you know, and I've been an art director for another VR studio. So now the roles are switched. I'm like, oh my gosh.
These are
the very I'm on the other end of it all. And so extending grace, being kind to people, and seeing the best in people. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I was talking to my friend last week, and I say this often, like, I don't have to prove to someone that I don't like them. I feel like sometimes part of different people's cultures is like, and I'm talking about in America, where if they don't like them, they have to, like, you know, tell them and prove and all this stuff and do all this. And I'm just like, sometimes depending on the reason I don't like a person, I might distance myself from them, but I won't make it very obviously clear that I don't like them. And sometimes that has resulted in the people I don't like opening doors for me and providing me with opportunities.
Yeah.
Because I don't mind. Prove it.
It's funny, because in my career as a, you know, as an artist, there are people that I've actually met that just rubbed me the wrong way, you know? And it's not that I hated them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just our personality was just different, right? And I had to recognize that they are just different from me. Mm-hmm. And we can never really exist like properly in the same wavelength, just like in music. When you play a certain chord, if it's not in the right key, it's not going to sound good.
Mm-hmm.
The strings are separate for a reason, right? Each string has its separate kind of music it produces. But together, you know, when you press them together to make a chord, those different strings create music. right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm learning in life, that even though someone is totally different from me, they might see life in a different, they may even be in a different political, you know, spectrum altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But together, when we are together, you know, everyone can bring something good to the table so that we can actually change the world.
Yeah.
Even as different as we are, even as incompatible as we might be.
You're right.
We all have a wavelength that we can contribute to a chord to people. When someone strums us together, that something beautiful comes out.
Right. So how do you personally stay connected with your culture living in the States?
Oh, so we have cultural events that we attend every now and then. What I've done, especially through Nkosa and Nanche, I volunteer. There's a Luganda Academy here in Washington, D.C. that serves Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. And so we try to meet with kids and share our culture. I teach Luganda, and I also share through the animation part of it. And I'm trying to make it fun, you know, because I remember how like mundane they made it for us during using the textbooks. I want to make it fun, you know. Mm-hmm. So I actually, in the app, the Nkosa Nancha app, we've added video games that take the language lesson itself and make it fun. So it's almost like we gamify the language. So there's like a leaderboard of some kind, and you're trying to beat yourself, how you pick the language, matching the sound of the food, for example, the picture, and you have a timer over here, you know, and also using animation so mm-hmm. that we can create like animated songs, sing-alongs. I've received so many clips from parents that I've taken some of the videos that are on our YouTube channel, on Nkosa Nancha YouTube channel, with little kids just dancing to these clips, you know, because I love Tom and Jerry, and we grew up on Tom and Jerry watching it. We loved it. But if I can find a way for the kids, since they love animation, but what if we add a cultural value to it, you mm-hmm. know, so that even as they are dancing, but they're also listening to the nursery rhymes. And I've worked with different people. We have a team in, Diana Ranga, who's in the UK. We have Bruno Sekandi, who's based in Uganda, with Mark. Like, we have a diverse team from different parts of the country, of the world, rather, that we are trying to connect and trying to find a way to still be able to give back through teaching. And I remember when the pandemic hit in 2020, at the time, we only had like 800 downloads of our app, right? Mm-hmm. Once every school closed down and parents, the kids were sent back to stay with their parents for long stretches over time. It's actually just feels like years have passed, but it's only been like 2 years, really.
Right.
But during that time, our app was downloaded multiple times. So right now, as we speak, we're about 17,000 downloads in about 150 countries. And to me, that's an evidence of parents around the world looking for resources to be able to tap into this cultural aspect of it. But I also play music that's from Uganda. When I dream, I dream in my language. When I'm singing, when I'm playing music, I try to play in my language as much as possible. When I'm on the highway, I try to play music from my country, mm-hmm. you know, so just stay connected, yeah.
Is there any kind of animation landscape that you know of in Uganda?
So animation in terms of land in sparse, so to speak, mm-hmm. but there are companies now, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like almost like brain drain in a way, whereby the best of the best are outside of Uganda, you know? Mm-hmm. But there is there's a company, an animation company called Admire, and also another company, Creatures Animation Studio. They made the Kalabanda animation. So, and also there's another gentleman, his name is Richard Musenguzi, who started 2D animation in Uganda, but now he's also in France, you know? So like even Ibrahim, who I think you've had with Kugali,
mm-hmm.
he's also like, the opportunities are outside of Uganda. It seems like people are looking for opportunities outside of Uganda. So what I'm trying to do is, when I get an opportunity to create something, I always go back to mm-hmm. Uganda to find other animators that I can work with. And so it's slow. It used to be like a really sparse landscape, but it's changing.
Yeah.
Because the advent of YouTube, and also the improvement in bandwidth, because When I was going to school, we didn't have YouTube. We didn't have Instagram. There's no Facebook. I think at the time there was MySpace. So kids nowadays have access to YouTube videos, and because of the improvements in bandwidth, they can watch tutorials. So you're starting to see more and more Ugandans digging into animation and 3D, and also the democratization of motion capture systems like the perception neuron. You're seeing more and more like companies leaning into that kind of tech, and I'm hoping I've played a part because I do a lot of tutorials. I'm
Yes,
hoping,
you
yeah, I'm hoping that someone will get an idea and say, ah, I can do that as well.
So, what are your thoughts? I mean, obviously you have this app and everything, but what are your thoughts on getting more content with Uganda and African characters in TV and movies?
Oh yeah, growing my team for sure. And I think that's where the business aspect comes in, because you have to realize as the business owner, as the leader of the company, you have to be looking for business. I remember I worked for a company called it's Florio as an art director, and I was inspired by the CEO of the company. His name is Vijay. I just lapped up just watching him as a business leader, because man, he would go to fly to the West Coast, fly to Canada just to do demos. It had never actually occurred to me that an app could be a product. I always thought that you had to have brick and mortar things in order for business to thrive, but he cre we created this app to help kids who are on the spectrum. His son is on the autism spectrum, so he was inspired by his son to be able to create a solution for him. And right now, it's being used in all manner of schools, in Virginia, in Maryland, and also on the West Coast in California. And they're using it abroad as well. And it's just an app, that people install on their phones and on an iPad as well. And people are able. So once I saw that. And in a way, I was like, I was there for almost 2 years. And I think God took me there to learn, first of all, how to be a business person. Second, to learn how to create an app, because I'd never, learned how to program or anything inside of Unity. But once I dug into Unity, I just fell in love with it. So that's how I got into writing code, creating an app for using Unity, and then providing it. So we create a iOS version, Android version, and Amazon version as well. So that can be found on all those platforms. But it's been extremely, extremely rewarding. And you have to grow the team, because without a team, you can't churn out extra content. And in a way, I held back creating new content because I saw the industry shifting. I wanted to make convincing facial animation, right? But every time I was about to do an episode, I would see on the horizon new technology showing up. And then, for example, iClone 8 came out, Live Link came out, the Unreal Engine came out. I'm like, oh my goodness. I used to render in Mental Ray. It would take hours and hours and hours to get something done. But real-time rendering and access to a motion capture system changed the way I do work. Because now I can just jump in a suit and create an episode, and it takes me about a week. Would have taken me a month or so just to come up with something like that. So just the nature of real time, the advent of the Unreal Engine, Unity changing also, because the app itself has we built the app using Unity. But now with the purchase of Weta Digital, I can say, I'm like, ah, Unity, I see you. I see what you guys are doing. Yeah. So now I'm leaning more into Unity as well. So you're gonna be seeing a lot more Unity tutorials, because they're working on a lot of cool things too.
Nice. So what do you hope for the future of animation as far as innovation, storylines, and characters?
My hope is that we get to a point where anyone can bring their story to life without selling their soul. You know, because right now we're all like striving to get on Disney Plus or Netflix and you know, Hulu and whatever, and those are the big ones. But how much better could be if someone could, everyone could create like their own platform, you know, and people could access your platform. They pay you on your platform. You don't have to give up, you know, 70% of your idea so that you get it. Because I want people to own their content. I want them to own their stories without giving away everything just to get an idea, you know, because I remember reading the story of James Cameron, and he came up with that Terminator in a dream. He dreamt, he had a dream, like a literal dream of the Terminator. He wrote it down, but he sold it so that he could get a chance to direct it. And it took him a while to get those rights back. You know, so those years and years of where people made money out of his idea, he lost out on that. Eventually, he got it back and he was able to create a, you know, a version of the Terminator, but he missed out so much.
Yeah.
And I know he had a, because that was a baby, his baby. He really wanted it to come to life, and it did come to life. And doors were opened as a result. But I feel like when we get an idea, I feel like we should get an opportunity to actually, and my hope is that actually me, I don't even want to just look at other people. I would like to be able to create a fund of some kind, because I know how much I've struggled to fund my own content. I would like to be able to create a fund where there are no strings attached, you know, that an artist who has an idea can come and say, please help me out. I have this awesome, awesome idea. I just need funding, you know, and just he, so that he gets an idea and an opportunity to do that. I know it will take a lot of money because there are many, many millions and millions of artists, but that's my dream.
Yeah.
That I want to be able to help other artists bring their, you know, visions to life without having to sell their songs.
Have you watched the ILM documentary Light and Magic?
Actually, no, I've not.
You should watch it.
Okay.
It's on Disney Plus.
Homework. Yes.
Yeah, six episodes. I'm starting episode four, but it's just the first three episodes so far have been like just George Lucas kind of talk about creating Star Wars. And creating Industrial Light and Magic. So
it's his story is incredible.
Yeah.
So the guys that inspire me, James Cameron and Stan Lee, you know, and Disney, their stories are incredible. Stan Lee, because he lived to be almost 100, he saw his like legacy play out.
Right.
I mean, all those cameos of whenever I see Stan Lee in as a cameo in one of his creations, it just warms my heart. I'm like, oh my gosh, look at that.
Yeah.
Someone had an idea and he actually lived long enough to see it become like a huge franchise.
See the fruit.
Yeah. And then Disney being fired from the job in New York, and then him taking that idea and then just growing it to where we are right now. I mean, Marvel is Marvel because they've been purchased by Disney, and all that influx of money has opened up. And Pixar, you know, I could go on and on. Yep.
So what do you hope that Ugandan and African animators are doing in this current landscape that you wish you could have done when you were younger and that you're doing now, like with all this access to technology and internet? What do you hope they're doing?
Yeah, my hope, and the whole of Africa, well, starting with my homeland, Uganda, is that people realize that their stories are valuable, you know, that their stories are valid, that they don't have to water down a story so that they can appeal, you know, to the Western community. We have like a wealth of folk tales in Uganda and also in the whole of Africa. They're just waiting to be told, you know. I'm hoping that people stay authentic, that they are able to tell their own story. They are in how the African folk tales have influenced them, and then they take that and share their experience as a result. But also to find a way of giving back. Like if you find success, please give back, you know, invest in other Africans and other Ugandans, teach them. Like, my whole purpose is whenever I do something like a YouTube video, I'm always thinking of a young animator out there on a little laptop with a small screen, a dimly lit room, with this big dream, wanting to bring that to life. You know, how can I inspire that artist, whether it's a child, a teenager, even if you're older, you know, because there are so many people who are artists who are older, who are almost giving up their dream. Mm-hmm. But I want to inspire even across the age spectrum, that people can still bring their stories to life and be rewarded for it, you know, be recognized for that. And then so they can give back as a result.
Yeah, I definitely agree with things being, you know, culture being valuable, because sometimes you, like, as like a Black American and wanting to consume African content, sometimes it's like they're doing other stuff. And then honestly, the same thing is happening with Black American culture, because we don't feel like our culture is viable. So we either do white stuff or African stuff. Like, yes, we are African, but our, like, Black American culture is a culture. So you can do that stuff too. Yeah. So I feel like we all kind of come into our own and realize how valuable our cultures are.
Yeah. And I don't want people to just stay on what was told before, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want people to come up with new African stories.
Yeah.
Create a legacy. I mean, our great-great-great-grandparents came up with these stories to teach us morals, right? And some of those stories may not apply to this life right now. Mm-hmm. So come up with a story that fits in our cultural experience. You know, don't wait for other people to come to tell you your African story. Please don't, you know, because that's happening more and more. People will come and tell you African history,
yeah.
You know, your own history, and they'll tell your own story. I'm like, you have lived it. Yes. You know, share it from your perspective. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the last question, if someone was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your work in animation?
Man, I think first and foremost, being able to inspire others to pursue their dream, because I've been on this journey to pursuing my dream for a long time. I started as a young artist, and it's taken me a long time to get here. And there's so many lessons that I've learned along the way. So if someone is doing that documentary, if they could just somehow capture, you know, those lessons that I've learned, and also highlight the people that helped me to get to this point. I mean, I want to throw out names like Nelson Hurst. He's a Black artist he's the first Black artist that inspired me to be organized, be confident about being Black in this industry, mm-hmm. and know that people will listen to you. And then there's Reynaldo Leon. I call him Ray Bomb. He was a classmate of mine at Montgomery College. He's the one that taught me 3DS Max for sure, you know, and he has helped me so much on my journey to grow. And then, of course, Alnugo Vinji, the gentleman that invested in me when I was in Uganda, you know, and Hazel Collett, you know, and my dad and mom and my brothers and sisters that have encouraged me to get to this point. So those are the things that I would like people to focus on, that to remember, first of all, that you don't get here on your own. Your parents, your relatives, or someone who loves you helped you along the way, and my wife and kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if somebody wants to follow your work, where can I do that?
Yes, I'm on all manner of social platforms. I'm on Instagram and also YouTube as Solomon Jagwe. But I also have a company with my wife called Soul Studios. So you can find me on Twitter as Surreal. Someone actually tried to buy my name. They said, how much would you like to give me your name?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I want to. So Surreal, SORREEL on Twitter and also Instagram. So yeah, find me on YouTube. I think that on my website, www.soul.com, on the right-hand side is like a whole menu of all my social links over there. Yeah.
And for everyone, Soul is spelled S-O-W-L. And I want to thank you for allowing me to highlight you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You know, it was funny how this was meant to happen, but it took a chance meeting. It really did. I'm telling you, my life has always been about chance meetings, like coincidences. Mm-hmm. But I knew we were eventually going to have a conversation. And here we are.
Yeah,
because it finally happened.
Finally, after years.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing is that you are probably the first one that I've shared my life story to this degree. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking for about an hour and 30 minutes, but this is the first time that I've actually threaded it out.
Yeah. That's my specialty.
thank you so much. The questions that you asked were very, very important and prodding, mm-hmm. and they gave me an opportunity to answer. So thank you.
No problem.
And people, please subscribe.
Yeah. Yes. Press that subscribe button wherever it is.
and hit the notification bell so you're alerted when Deborah, the Black Woman Animator, posts a new video.
Show your passion.
That's right.
To everyone out there, I want you to like so I know it's real. Comment, tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Soda Deal and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it.